And welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. This is Frank Scappaticci. I'm going to solo host today. I'm without my partner, John, but I am with a very special guest. I'm with Dr. Julie Gerner, someone I follow on Twitter, subscribe to her newsletters. I'm a big fan of everything she puts out, along with my wife. Doctor, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. So you're a different guest. I think you're the first guest we've ever had that is not a real estate operator at all. But I love what you do, so I was really excited you said you'd come on. But for our listeners that might not be familiar, can you just give a quick explanation of who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I'm a doctor of psychology and executive performance coach. So my job is really getting individuals who are operating at the top of their fields, usually in high pressure situations, who are builders looking to expand and to grow. And I help them kind of reach their personal potential in the businesses that they operate. A lot of times that does include people in the real estate industry. So in that respect, I guess that, I may not be as unknown to some of your listeners as I could be.
Got it. And how did you get into this space? Because I performance coaching to a lot of people, they don't even know what it is. So how did you, where'd you start? Sure. How'd you get into this?
Sure. So I started very traditionally in psychology. You know, when I went to graduate school, I had no idea that this was even an option as a career. My expertise was in adult psych pathology and forensics, so a very different area of expertise. And I had a lot of background in personality theory. You know, to do forensic evaluations, you have to really understand people pretty well. And I was doing some academic work, and I had been periodically, tapped to advise on products. So I would, advise on a product on cognitive load, or advise on a product and how it impacts someone, from a personality standpoint or their psychology. Psychologists are often tapped to, kind of advise and engage on products. And so, I was doing that for one particular company, and a venture firm who was supporting that company came to me and said, "Hey, we're having a founder in our portfolio who's struggling with decision making. He just had a massive round of funding. He's usually a really solid operator, and he is just paralyzed. You're the only psychology person we even know. Could you just talk to him?" So I did that. We had a few meetings. It went really well. The problem was really clear to me. And, within a month, he was back on track and doing the kinds of decisions that he had been known for and making great moves. And I began to kind of get some referrals in the space, but also it was a real light bulb moment for me, because for me, these things were very clear. And for other people, I think they're much more hazy. It was really using psychology, which usually is making people from ill to well, or evaluating them, and getting people who are very healthy, very well, but may have these slight tweaks that need to be made, and being able to find, almost surgically find, what those things are and move them in a certain direction. And, it was using all the literature I already knew, all the methods I already knew, to be able to get healthy people and to move them into optimal spaces. And there was really an entire market there that was looking for that kind of assistance. And so really began to kind of grow my own reputation, had a company that exited, that had a pretty phenomenal exit that I was a part of, and working with some members of that team, and started to get more and more of a reputation as it grew. And, finally, having that mentioned in the Wall Street Journal a bit, I think gave other people an understanding more of what I do when they compared it to Wendy Rhodes of Billions. I think that finally my mom understood what I've been doing for the past so many years for the very first time.
That's cool. I want to definitely get to the performance stuff, coaching, sure, in a second. But you said personality theory, and I think I know what that means. But what does that mean?
Okay, so personality theory is really all about why we become who we are, and all of the different, there are different types of theories as to why that is, why we end up the people that we are. But when you understand a variety of theories and you're able to integrate them, I tend to take a very cognitive framework. So for anyone who's out there and kind of a theory nerd, I really like the theories of Aaron Beck. I really like Albert Ellis. I really like some of the more cognitive frameworks. And really thinking about, you know, people often focus on their past a lot. Like they'll focus on childhood, or they'll focus on, oh, my experiences in my childhood or some hurts or pains. I really take the approach of, you know, who are you when you look in the mirror right now? And let's work with that man or woman who's standing there today, because that's the one that matters. Going back too much is useful as a reference point sometimes. But when we're talking about personality theory, we're talking about the theory of why you are the man or woman that you are today. And, you know, my job in, as far as in my role, oftentimes is I help people see themselves more clearly, more effectively, and help to bring forward some of the traits that really help them move in their work and in their life, instead of sometimes people tend to focus on some of the traits that may, you know, be challenges or be obstacles in how they want to move to the next place in their life.
That's really interesting. And I can relate to that, like help people understand who they are. But how do you start that process? Like, someone comes to you and they're like, I need help with this. I'm struggling with A, B, C, D. And you're like, okay, I got to figure out who you are. Like, what's step one in doing that?
So I think that this is where it's a strange thing. I don't think I've ever discussed this on another podcast. So I think this is really interesting. I think this is where forensic training really has been a real win for me, because you do have to understand people very thoroughly from a variety of perspectives. For me, in doing this work, to really try to short circuit that a little bit, the way I think about it is every single person I meet, whether they are, you know, making a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, or they're somebody who's running a $1 billion business, they all come to me because they know they can be greater than where they're at right now. So my job is not just to understand, help them understand who they are, but really understand what are the variables that are kind of keeping them from being this person that they know they could be. To me, that is the most important thing, is understanding that blocker, because they probably have gotten to a certain point in their life right now. If they're working with me, I know they've gotten to a certain point in their life where they've been able to be effective. So I try to look, what are all the things that have made you so effective so far? And there are probably a number of them someone could list, right? You know, they've been, usually they're action oriented or have a bias to action. Usually they're self-learners. And if you're in self-storage, you know that you've got to be a self-learner to some extent to be able to figure out optimizations. And you're not afraid of doing that. That's a great skill. So there are a lot of things that get you to where you're at. My job is to kind of, you know, when you say to figure out who you are, as that will be something that evolves over time. But the first thing I want to locate is like, what's the blocker here? Because it's going to be something personally. It's not going to be a skill. Skills are easy to learn. And there's something that people in your position or people in other people's position, I mean, they're great at learning skills. So I know already going into our meeting that something's going on with you personally that you haven't figured it out yourself, because these are people who figure almost everything out themselves. So I know that like, this is what we're dealing with. And then if they trust me enough to kind of talk about it, I'm looking for points of frustration. So if anybody can point to like, this is an area I'm really frustrated in, this is an area I'm really frustrated in, to me, those are the areas that if you're out in the audience right now, I would focus in very deeply, because people tend to avoid those areas. I want to like, it's like if someone says, look, I'll talk to you about everything but the drinking, you go, oh, I'm definitely going to talk about the drinking. Like the drinking is definitely important, yeah, right? Yeah. So we avoid things that we're frustrated with and that we don't like. And those are the areas I really want to dive into, because if we can get those things to move and we figure out what's blocking them, then we figure out a lot of other things about what's going on with you personally. Because usually it's not just that thing that's stuck. There's like three other layers below it that is preventing movement on that, on a variety of areas.
What? You're dealing with a lot of high performing individuals, mm-hmm. and they have a lot of success, probably big egos in a lot of cases too. I think that kind of goes, you know, in tow. What are some of the most common challenges you see amongst your clients?
I think one of the most common challenges is that they are frustrated that their teams are not operating at the same pace they are. Their mm-hmm. teams are not as engaged as they are. They're not as dedicated as they are. They're not as like immersed in it as they are. I think that's almost always a challenge, because it's hard to recognize that you're sitting and maybe this sounds somewhat elitist and I don't mean it to, but you're sitting in your seat for a reason, that like mm-hmm. you are the owner or you are the person at a certain position because of in part who you are. And so the traits of other people are going to be different because of who they are. And sometimes they're going to be phenomenal and you need them, but they aren't going to always have your traits specifically. So I think a common problem is, you know, sometimes frustration with their teams, their level of engagement or motivation. Oftentimes it's people problems. So sometimes in communication, how they communicate, how effectively they communicate with others. Another common problem is I think sometimes their own frustration and like life balance, right? I mean, they are incredibly dedicated to what they do. They have really big goals they want to push ahead. But, you know, when you have those goals and you're working within a system or you're married or you have other commitments in your life, you know, balancing all those out can be really challenging. They also have some challenges sometimes with emotional regulation. So, you know, they feel strongly, they're intense people. How do you kind of do the things you need to do and be able to kind of modulate that appropriately, which doesn't mean stuffing it, but rather using some of those really strong emotions as push or challenge to kind of drive them forward. There are a number of different problems. They tend to be as individuals, the person who comes to the table, but those are some common ones.
Yeah, it's interesting. And my understanding is you're typically hired to increase performance of a person or an organization. But do you ever find that that's sometimes in conflict with like what makes this person happy, right? I find a lot of like high performing people kind of are on the edges. They work a lot of hours. Schedules can be a little crazy, right? They have family concerns. Like, do you ever feel like you're at conflict or like you have to solve those problems too? Like, how do you balance those two things?
I think that's a really good question. I think that one of the things we know in research is that grit is correlated with happiness, right? So, you know, if people see themselves as gritty, they often are also more happy with themselves and who they see themselves being. I don't see it. I think that how people approach their big goals and their life is often in conflict, but I don't think that having big goals and having that kind of life is in conflict. So, my job would be that how they're approaching it, like we often approach our massive goals in ways that are inefficient and sometimes immersive in the worst ways. And we don't kind of see that we have the ability to shift ourselves into our places of highest leverage and highest use. And we can, by doing that, we can free up time to be able to spend more time in the things that also matter to us in our lives. I don't think that anyone who does big things is going to have a particularly balanced life, at least not for a long time. But I do think that they can create space for the things that are important to them in ways that they often don't see, because we're changing as we grow, right? Like when you're first starting your business, you have absolutely no time. And so what often happens cognitively is people start to associate work with grinding, right? And the work is grinding at first. And the work is grinding as you build a little bit. But as you grow, the work becomes less about the grind and the like kind of, you know, roll up your sleeves and doing it all. And it comes more about other things, the relationships you're forming with the bank, for example, the, you know, networks that you're building with brokers, the things that you're doing that like are actually very expansive and growth oriented to your work that no one else can do. And then the kind of the tasks and the grind, you should be kind of having other people doing some of those things. So you're really, you know, the process of building is you doing all of this grind work at first and then really pulling out of it toward the end to be able to do the things that are of the highest leverage. And if you can do that, you can create space, even though you're very engaged, for things that are not in opposition to happiness, if that makes sense.
No, that's a great point. And it's, you said highest and best use. It's, that can be scary. Like one, because you're giving up control. And then two, it also, for some people, I could see them saying like, I'm good at everything. they don't know they're bad at stuff. And that's
hard. And also they may be great at everything, but it doesn't mean you should be doing it, right? Yeah. Like you are not the right person to be doing everything, even if you're great at it. And the truth of it is somebody doing your job that you're great at 80%, if it's just a grind job, is absolutely fine because your highest growth areas are not going to be in kind of like creating a spreadsheet or doing a financial model. Like, that is not going to be your highest and best use. That's not how the business is going to grow. That's not how it's going to be massive. Like, I'm sure that Jeff Bezos is really good at a lot of things, but you know what, it eventually, as Amazon grew, his highest and best use became making 2 to 3 high leverage decisions every day. And when you start to feel like you're losing control, because I heard that word and it was like a big flag went up for me, is that I see how that happens, because you do feel like, you know, you're pulling away from your own business. And if you're doing it right, you should be keeping these connection points with people who are doing some of the work that you're no longer doing. And you should have great detail and insight into what's happening there. It doesn't mean that you lose insight, even if you're not the person doing that work. But it, you know, you create systems around that so that you are completely informed and in touch, or you have dashboards or other types of things. Mm-hmm. But you know, pulling into these kind of higher levels, if you stay in the areas where you feel like control equates with keeping your hands in the pudding all the time, you're going to limit growth. So you have to be able to allow other people to do some of those things. And then you begin to do these really kind of higher level things. You know, sometimes it's hard for people who've done the kind of like groundwork to see going to a meeting with like, you know, someone at the bank as being part of their work. They think of it as like, oh, I'm going to a lunch, like lucky me, it's a great thing. But if that relationship brings you 5 deals that you wouldn't have gotten, that's like, that's a massive move, right? And it's worth its weight in gold.
I relate a lot, because we're in that transition now. Like, we, 2 years ago, I was doing a lot of the nug work, and now we're growing. Yeah. Last week, we took some days off to like network with people from RE-TWIT. We had a golf thing. We had this.
Nice.
I think the other challenging part is traceability. Like, if in real estate, for example, you get a lease signed, you're like, okay, next month I'm going to get paid, right? It's like very, very clean. You go out to lunch with a prospective investor, you don't know when it's going to pay off, and it might be 2 years from now. So like, kind of like the marshmallow test to a certain extent, which is, I think, a struggle for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think you have to plant a lot of seeds.
Yeah. Right. What is the best thing about what you do?
The best thing about what I do is that I get to see what big looks like across a variety of industries. And they are, it's something that I would not get to see outside of the seat that I'm in. So that's one thing. The second thing is that I think that another great thing about what I do is that there is an ability to be a partner with individuals who are making some really big decisions and really big moves without having to have the public profile of somebody who is making those moves. So I don't personally, I think there are a lot of people who like being in front of the scenes, like who like being the cover person. And I've always been much more comfortable as the consulting, like consigliere, the person behind the scenes, I guess. And so it allows me to have a major impact in a lot of decisions without having to be the person who necessarily is the public face of the companies that move forward. So, for example, you know, I can hash out a decision with someone, you know, and help them kind of think through it. And certainly they make every call that is made. And at the end of the day, the next, you know, the next month we may meet for some clients, I'll meet them monthly. And, you know, the bottom line moves a significant amount, or they begin an M&A process that ends up with, you know, a significant addition to their company. And that is incredibly gratifying for me on a very deep level, because I get to see these kind of large moves happen in real time and add value. And I get to see the tangible outcomes of my value all the time. So it to me, that's very fulfilling. I think in a traditional psychology role, you really hope for very qualitative outcomes. You know, people feel better, or, you know, all of those things. I get to see that, like, you know, I may charge a certain amount for my services and for my work, but I get to watch as like the bottom line moves for a lot of companies, and the value that is added through the work that we do is sometimes very tangible. And I don't have to be the front-facing person for that. I don't care to be. But it's a very gratifying thing to say, okay, because of our work, you know, I've watched this company go from making X amount of dollars to, you know, another amount of dollars that is, you know, 10 times maybe what I would charge. So I watch the dollars pay for myself all the time, I guess. And that's very gratifying for me.
That's really, really cool. Do you ever, so you mentioned M&A before, you know, sometimes I'm sure your clients talk about deals with you that are ongoing all the time. Sure. And I'm sure that they're in charge of all the quantitative analysis with the deal, right? Like all the numbers and the underwriting, they do that. Do you ever find yourself getting involved and like, hey, you should do it? is it tempting sometimes to be like, this deal looks awesome? Like, you, like, how do you balance that?
I do not. Well, I think that how I balance it is that I understand who carries ultimate responsibility, and I don't want that. So I'm more than happy to be a sounding board and to ask the right questions to help people come to decisions that will benefit them. And I also am really, I think, useful in calling out, you know, sometimes people will have hesitations, and it's when you have hesitations, it's not always based on things that you wish it was. Like sometimes the numbers can look great and you still know it's the wrong deal to make. And so kind of like hashing that out, because what happens is these are the points where people will do a deal that they feel in their gut is wrong. And then it ends up like biting them 6 months down the road. And they didn't see at the time why it was wrong. But if they would have had someone to hash that out with, even if the numbers looked okay, maybe they had a bad feeling about this or that, and it's something outside of those sheets that's really kind of giving them concern. You don't always have a partner to kind of hash those things out with or ask the right questions. And so you end up second guessing your own gut instinct about things, even when the numbers look great. And so we'll explore it to see like, hey, does this make sense? Does it not make sense? Why are you hesitating? What's that about? And sometimes it's about things that are completely valid. And sometimes they're about other things like, oh, I'm going to have to hire like X amount of people. And like, they just don't want that headache, right?
Yeah, not a good reason. It's not a good reason.
Right. And I'll ask them like, is this a reason? And you know, for some people, maybe they don't want to really expand. Maybe they want to stay a certain level, or they don't want to get to a certain place. And that's okay. But like figuring out exactly, this is where it's like, you know, you get really clear about what you want, what you're building toward. And then we start really constructing. And I know then to ask you questions that will lead you to where you say you want to go. And if you don't want to go there, you know, you can push against that and we'll, you know, we'll hash that out together. But I think that's part of my job is to really do the things you're hiring me to do, which is to challenge you, in specific ways. And that's why when I do engage with people, I ask like, what are the goals that you have for working together? Because I'll measure myself against those goals as well. That's how I know I've done a good job. I don't just say, hey, let's just like start talking randomly. I ask them like, what are the things that you really want to work on? What are the goals that you have? And my goal is to line up and sync with your goal, because that's how I'm going to measure myself. So it puts us very much on the same page as we move forward.
Is that emotionally challenging? Because you're, to a certain extent, I could see how your self-worth at work could be tied to other persons. So does that ever become a challenge?
That's a good question. You know, like for me, my worth, my work is only part of my worth. So, you know, if everything tomorrow changed and I no longer could do this job, I think it'd be very devastating for me, because I really do love it. I'm like the scientist in the lab that studies one cell and they just do it forever and ever. Mm-hmm. I think that at the same time, it's challenging because sometimes people are, how shall we say, it's hard for people to move out of their way. And I will have clients that will dig in their heels and say, you know, like they won't do the work that is required to get to a certain place. You know, you have to, I've fired clients in the past. I tell people that every client I have is my calling card in the world, right? I mean, that's how my reputation is built. So if people don't want to move and they don't want to really be engaged, I can't continue that relationship. You know, like there are a line of people who want to move and want, are invested and, you know, want to scale and want to grow. And, you know, to stick with an individual who is refusing to make motion or isn't engaged in the ways that they need to be, you know, I have to think about my own reputation in the world, and I have to think about, you know, where my talents are best used. And I don't think that that is a good, you know, use of my time.
Yeah, that's a great answer. That's very honest of you too. I have a question, and this is something I've been curious about. You see people, I assume, across a lot of different age spectrums, probably mostly 30s through mid-50s, I'm guessing. How do stressors and struggles of these high-performing individuals change as people go from like 30 to 55, or does it?
It's a good question. I have some people in their late 20s as well who found some pretty early success. So that's a really good question, because I think that early on, you have people who have their first experience with big catastrophic or big failures, right? People in their 40s and 50s, if they're still in it, they are grizzled and they have had some hits and they have some war stories to tell you, and they're still around to tell the tale. Mm-hmm. I think people in their late 20s and sometimes early 30s, that's when you're having people who take some really big hits. You know, they've gone through, this is their first big, economic challenge. The economy is really odd right now, especially if you're in real estate. So I think that they're going through some of the growing pains that people in their 40s and 50s have already gone through, and they're on the other side of. They may not have always gone through it well. They may even have some kind of scars. Like, you'll see that people in their 40s and 50s sometimes, you know, they're still, they'll reduce their risk taking because of a challenge they had in their 30s when they went bankrupt the first time, or something like that, right? So you're doing some repair work in your 30s, and in your 20s, maybe you're doing some work that is a little bit more, kind of getting through something effectively and going through to the other side. I think that the challenge is then, you know, people who are seasoned are going to have very different challenges, by their nature, than people early on. And the people who are really hungry in their 20s tend to take on, I don't want to say less calculated risks, because that would be wrong, but the way in which they calculate risk is different. So they're willing to lose a lot more. They have a lot less to lose as far as, you know, the capacity to build. When you're of a certain age, you have relationships that are seasoned. Mm-hmm. You have more assets typically. You have more on the line in your reputation because you've built a certain reputation. Whereas, you know, like, there's one guy I work with abroad in Singapore who, you know, like, he'll decide to go into a different industry entirely, and just, you know, he's a fairly young guy, and just decide, well, you know, I don't really know anything about this industry, but I see a vulnerability. I'm just going to, you know, kind of go for it. And he, you know, really doesn't care about, risking X million dollars, because for him, you know, it's worth it for him. He can always, yeah. He feels he can always rebuild it. But somebody who's a little bit later in the game, they can risk a certain amount of dollars, but they'll do it because it's excess, not because, you know, I could lose it all if I lose this and, oh, well, and I'll just rebuild. It's a very different risk calculus sometimes.
Yeah. There's also this weird dynamic where I find that the older I get, and I think a lot of people do this, the more long-term you think, which is kind of ironic because you actually have less time.
That's true.
It doesn't make any sense, but I feel like everyone follows that trajectory. So that maybe that's at play as well. Or maybe what you said is the reason why. I don't know. Maybe.
No, it could be. That's a great point, because I do think people are playing a longer game when they get older. I think they realize that there's a lot more fruit to be had playing a long game. And when you're younger, I think those dopamine hits of early wins feel different. When you're older, I think they feel good, but you realize, you know, there's something on the other side of that door.
Well, I think if you're also in the business of raising money, like short-term investments, you don't realize at a young age of how much stress that actually puts on your business.
Yes,
right? Like, true. Turning everything over, expectations for investors, yada, yada, yada. It just makes everything harder. So yeah. I think that's also part of it.
Good point.
I also want to talk about your newsletter. Full disclosure, I know, you know, I read it, but my wife and I actually both read it every Monday. So we actually debrief morning coffees on Mondays over your newsletter. That's how
I love that.
I love it. But I wanted to ask why the newsletter, like, why? Because you already have this other amazing thing going on. And then what are you trying to accomplish with it?
I think that people are, there's really a few ways in which I kind of scale out. So I work with corporations, which is not something really on my page or something I really talk a lot about. Then I work with, you know, individuals, which I think is what I'm most known for. And, you know, I get a lot of requests for people to work with me. Right now, my wait list is end of 2024, early 2025 at this point. So like I'm one person. There's only so many individuals I can work with. The other thing too, is that there are a lot of people who are building who, you know, may not want to or be able to make that investment right now in, you know, a monthly retainer. So because I get these requests, I decided, hey, I'm going to start a newsletter. I'm going to start to distill some common themes and some elements from ultra successful people to and bring those down to everybody and see what they think, right? Like I have a window into how various people operate, whether it's, you know, I have clients who are athletes, I have clients who are in, you know, in tech, I have clients who are in real estate, I have clients who are in various other industries. But there are themes and the ways in which ultra successful people think. And that's why the newsletter is called Ultra Successful on Substack, just because it's pulling these lessons and these kind of concepts down and being able to just democratize them and bring them to everyone so that people can use some of the concepts while still keeping, you know, clients behind the scenes. The ways in which people think, I think, are really what differentiates, you know, the risks you end up taking, the decisions you make, the path you end up on. And so my goal really is to help everybody get to a certain place if that's where they want to go. And everyone can kind of hop on the train and go on the ride. You know, I don't come from money myself. You know, and this journey has been one for me as well. So I think that if, you know, I try to think about what would I have wanted, what are things that would have been useful, and what can be useful for the general public and is something that not everyone can bring them. So I try to bring that in a snippet every single week so that people can get a little bit of an insight, I guess.
Yeah, that's really cool. There's a dynamic where that I'm thinking about, because you, when you're with a client, your focus is just on that client, right? You're solving their problems and you've already done that for a long time. You're good at it, right? Now you have a newsletter, you kind of have your own enterprise. Like this is right. Like your
very different
Julie's thing. Do you ever take a step back and be like, apply some of the lessons you give your clients and like look at now your new business, or I don't want to say new, but your business, and like try to coach yourself? Cause you have like this new thing now, you know, like you're basically an entrepreneur. So like how do you look at that?
Well, I see myself as being an entrepreneur for a long time, right? Like I often say that I'm kind of an accidental entrepreneur, because if somebody would have paid me well to and allowed me to do the work I wanted to do at the caliber I wanted to do it, I probably would have stayed in a job forever. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's not always the way the world works. So, you know, I started my own consulting business and I've been doing it well over a decade. So I think that I've already seen myself as somebody who's had to be a builder. And so this is just like, and you have to figure it out. There's no place in grad school or any other place where they say, hey, if you're going to start your own business, this is how you do X, this is how you do Y. So like I had to figure out how exactly to get from, you know, this idea that I had after meeting with this founder to kind of building a business that, you know, is the one that I have today. And I see Ultra Successful, you know, the newsletter, very much just as an extension of, you know, my overall business. And I intend for that to grow. You know, I have certain goals set for it. I definitely have things that I want it to become. I want it to, you know, be able to continue to build and scale and grow. And I'm excited about it. I think that the thing that excites me most is that content outlives you. So, you know, like if I can put something out there, it will continue. Hopefully it continues to give people information, you know, long after like I've logged off for the day, somebody can be reading something that really gives them an idea. And if one idea changes the course of, you know, what professional decision they make or, you know, what they decide to do, then it's really done its job and paid for itself, you know, many times over. So I try to look at it as, hey, if you get much like a client meeting, I guess, and this is how it maybe I connect the two, is I think about with client meetings, if we make a decision together and, you know, you get an insight that changes what you, a decision that you make, and somehow that changes the bottom line, maybe by 5%, 10%, like you have effectively had sometimes a $1 million meeting, right, for that year because of this decision. And I think about the newsletter very similarly. If you're working through that content and there's something that strikes you and you go, oh, wow, I shouldn't have been, I should do something an entirely different way. Or you decide to do something and it takes a different course and you make yourself an extra $100, $200, $300,000 or more, like that newsletter's paid for itself. And I feel like the possibility is always there. I try to think about that possibility with each newsletter that I put out that, like, for example, there was one, whether it's on something that's personal development, like loneliness and climbing, if you reach out to a network like YPO and you're somebody who's in those circles, and then you make a connection at YPO that ends up a collaboration or partnership that changes the course of your business, that may have been sparked by a newsletter you read mm-hmm. that was $9.99, and now you've changed the trajectory of your business. So whether it's something like that, or it's something around being able to pull yourself objectively from your business, from being too emotionally invested, like the driver, not the car, was a very early edition, and looking at how, like, you, your business is what you do. It's not who you are. And having that distance perhaps allows you to make moves in it that aren't personal, right? And if it allows you to make more effective decisions and better moves, maybe that creates some momentum on the back end that helps you change the trajectory of your business. Or it makes you open to criticism or hearing something about your business that you wouldn't have been open to before, that then makes you have a correction that could have been, you know, something tragic. So I'm always trying to think about where are the value points and how could maybe 10 steps down the line, somebody pull something from this that really makes them more successful than they would have been without it. And that, to me, if there's one little nugget of value that people get either every week, once a month, you know, every few months, to me, that's a pretty great investment.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I think it's worth more than $10 a month.
Thank you.
How has the growth been on the newsletter?
The growth has been insane. I have been really excited about it.
Yeah.
I have been so excited about it. And it's why I created a Reddit community. I mean, if it gives you any indication, the Reddit community in the first week and a half was in the top 20% of all subreddits, right? So it grew like really fast. And now people are doing, like, some people are doing individual meetups. There's somebody who suggested a book club. Like, I allow the community to network with each other. And I think that also can be a real win for people. But yeah, the trajectory has been really surprisingly quick to grow. And I've gotten some really great shout outs from people who have, you know, supported it, who've used some of the models that we've put in. I had like a conflict resolution model that, you know, Sahil Bloom pulled into his newsletter. And there are some other people who are just kind of passing some elements around. So I do think that, you know, it's grown really quickly, and I've been really fortunate to get great reinforcement for the work that's been done there.
Mm-hmm. What's your creative process for writing that newsletter?
So I, my creative process is that I keep a running list of topics. And so after I have different client meetings, I'll think about, like, oh, okay. I form client every time I meet with a client, I take all the notes and I send them notes, usually within 24, 48 hours. But oftentimes there's concepts in there that, like, I thought about and I'm like, wow, this would be wonderful if, like, 99% of people really thought this way, or if 99% of people really made decisions this way. And so these concepts I'll just kind of pull out. And because I'm actually someone who does the work, I think there's a lot of people who we'll talk about, you know, some of these concepts who don't do the work. Maybe they're academics, maybe they do research, but, like, if you're in the trenches with people, the concepts that work are so much different than what you're going to read in a book. And so I try to really bring truth to people, even when it's kind of unpopular, a little sometimes unsavory, but, like, what is actually the truth of what works? And I'll be fairly uncompromising about that. So I'm always trying to pull and distill those truths, especially when they go against current wisdom, because I think current wisdom is easy to parrot, but oftentimes not as effective for people.
So do you find yourself being a little bit more contrarian then than some of your peers?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think that absolutely. Like, for example, I think one of the things that's really hard for people is that, like, a concept that I have talked about is that how, you know, discipline is not an effective long-term strategy, right? I mean, a motivation is, discipline really is not. Discipline should be used sparingly. And I think that that has always been, you know, everyone's like, oh, discipline. Discipline is great, but like if your whole life is discipline, you're going to burn out. It's not, motivation is being pulled, right? You get up every day, you're excited about what you do. It doesn't require discipline. Like if I asked you, like, what was your first date like with your wife? You don't go, wow, you know, I really had to, you know, garner some discipline there so I could get there and pick her up for that date. And it was really disciplined to like, you know, make sure that, I mean, you don't need discipline. You are pulled, you are excited, you're motivated. And, you know, when you feel that way about your work, you are a monster because no one really can compete with that. But if you're kind of dreading Mondays, you have to force yourself to get up, force yourself to go to these meetings, you know, like discipline is not how great movers operate. They often have to be told to turn off, like stop thinking about work, stop talking about work, like stop doing work. It is the weekend, you know, like it isn't, they don't require discipline. They require like an off switch. So I oftentimes find that like, a lot of times discipline is great for the off days, times you don't feel like going, and we all have those off days, but discipline isn't a great long-term strategy. And when you're relying on that, it's when like, you know, athletes retire, you know, when they have to, they're no longer pulled and motivated to be the best and no longer excited and, you know, amped up every day. So I do think that sometimes my advice can be a little contrarian, but I try to bring truth to people wherever they're at so that they understand that if you're forcing, for example, discipline every single day, you're probably in the wrong field.
So it's funny. I was reflecting upon, because I've said like my discipline, like waking up early, doing this, that, and the other, like helps me manage certain things. But I was thinking about, I do Dry January every year. Mm-hmm. And I found this January by like the third week, I'm like, every morning waking up so early, I'm so rigid and like so good that by the end of the month, my wife is like, you need to chill out because you're driving me nuts. Because like, it was just too intense. Like I became this like accelerating machine. So I'm like reflecting because now I'm like, oh, am I wrong? I don't know. Does that happen too? Do people get a little out of control when they get their discipline too jacked up?
I don't think that's discipline. If you're excited about getting up, is that really discipline? Or are you actually are genuinely excited to do it? Because it sounds like you are genuinely motivated to pop out of bed and get going.
Yeah, I am a morning person. Like at 4 p.m., I don't want to work. But at 5:30 a.m., I am ready to work. So yeah, that might be it too.
Discipline would be pushing through. It's like 6 p.m. and you're tired. And, you know, like, hey, now you have to answer 20 emails and, you know, get back to X, Y, and Z. And that might be a little bit more challenging.
Got it. What's the future of your business? You have now, I guess, a couple of verticals, I guess I'll call them. Are you just playing it by ear, or do you have a plan to grow the brand in the future?
I have a great plan to grow the brand in the future, of which I will not discuss.
Okay.
I'll be straightforward with you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. What are some of the hidden benefits of being a performance coach?
I think the hidden benefit is, one is you have an incredible network of people. Right. So I think that that's a benefit people don't think about. Sometimes, you know, I often will tell my spouse, if only venture companies knew how many great contacts they would have performance coaches as like scouts, because I get to talk to people, I get to see inside of businesses. I can tell you, I mean, I'm not 100% right, but I can certainly tell you a lot of companies that I think are going to be absolute home run winners in the future. And I'm not talking about now, I'm talking about like 10 years out, right? Like I have a couple mm-hmm. of companies that have hired me early on. There's a few venture firms actually that pay for folks like me early in order to give them funding. So like, for example, Alexis Ohanian, when he funds companies, he says, well, you have to use this percentage to pay for personal development. And so they'll often use it to pay for someone, you know, like me, if, mm-hmm. you know, people like me. So you get to see companies and founders very early on. And sometimes you'll see founders who, you know, like, oh my God, this person's a killer. Like they are going to eat everything in front of them. And this is going to be a monster. Other times you see folks and you're like, well, you know, like I can see how this will scale and I understand why it was funded. I'm not sure how big this is going to get or if it's going to reach the certain plateau. And right. I've seen companies through these various stages where you know, you get to see very early on how people tend to transition who are of certain dispositions. And so that's always really interesting. And I think that's something that's often missed.
Yeah, that is really, really cool. Okay. And then Twitter. So you have a big Twitter following.
I do.
You do. How did you come to that conclusion? How did you just, one day you woke up, you're like, I'm going to start using Twitter. Like, how did that evolve?
I have been using Twitter. I am probably not the person maybe to ask about Twitter, only because I think I've been using it for 10 years. If I looked at my profile, I've been using it for a long time.
Yeah.
So Twitter is not, I am not one of those people who are like, here's how to build your 100,000 person following in like 5 months. Mine built over many, many years. So I have not been as intentional until more recently in building that following. So I think that I've just always been putting messages out there. Sometimes they were received well and sometimes they were not. And then you just can, I think that more people came online, especially during the pandemic. That's when I saw a real afterburner effect for some reason. I think a lot of people were at home. They're spending more time online. They're thinking about their own development, their own life, what makes them happy. And so they began to seek, following different types of people. So that's when I really kind of became more invested in my own, you know, kind of Twitter. I feel much like the newsletter. It's just a way to get these pieces of information to people. It's a way to start conversations. You'll notice I comment in a lot of people's remarks. Mm-hmm. I'm not somebody who just, I don't do a, is it Naval, who just like posts it out there and then it's into the ether, doesn't follow anyone and doesn't really engage. I try to be less the philosopher on the mountaintop and I guess more the person who's going to put something out there. And I'm eager to hear how you respond, like push back a little bit. That's fine. Mm-hmm. Tell me why it works for you. That's fine. A lot of times people will, kind of share their own stories or DM me things. I always think that's really fun. It's also part of what made me think about the subreddit. Ultra successful because people were engaging with each other then in my comments. They're like, you know, starting to help each other out. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. Like, I wish there was a greater place for somebody to do that. But yeah, so Twitter has been wonderful. And it's also helped me make some really great, like, friendships and connections. I think sometimes people think about your online relationships as fake or not meaningful. And I've certainly not found that to be the case. I think people on Twitter, if you can find the right people on Twitter, I guess I'd say it that way, mm-hmm. you can find some really incredible human beings that you would never bump into on the street because you simply just, you know, they don't live 20 miles away from you. So it's nice, you know, especially in real estate, you know, I've watched as people, you know, Moses Kagan, I'll give him a shout out. He's a really nice guy. And super he nice. Does. He does a wonderful, you know, reconvene every single year. And I have had people come back and talk, you know, so wonderfully about that and the work that he does. And he seems like a very nice guy. I've talked to him, you know, not professionally, so I don't feel, mm-hmm. you know, but I've talked to him just on Twitter and on our DMs and stuff. He's a really just genuinely good guy. There are a lot of people like that out there. There are also a lot of scammers out there, I'm sure, but mm-hmm. I've been very fortunate to talk with some of the nice ones, I think.
Yeah. Do you use, because I know you have real estate investments, you've talked mm-hmm. publicly yeah. about your personal purchases. Do you use real estate Twitter to place capital too? Like, are you an
no.
LP?
No.
No.
Okay. No, I do
I'm
not.
I'm actually glad you said no, because if you said yes, they're probably like, we don't have a ton of you. We have a decent following.
Yeah.
And you'd have GPs messaging you like, hey, Dr. Gerner, check out this deal. But anyway.
No, I don't. I invest personally only because I think that, like, you know, I think the conventional wisdom is true that you should have a number of income streams, right? You shouldn't just yeah. have, if I'm never going to be dependent on just one thing. I think sometimes it looks like I have just one thing happening. I probably have like five things happening, one of which I'm known for, but you know, like, you know, rentals, you have other things that you're doing because you can't really count on, like, the stock market is very, who knows what's happening there. Mm-hmm. Real estate tends to be pretty stable if you're invested in it and you've invested well. You have your own, like, you know, the farm that I own also has income. It's also a business. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, it's, its own form of revenue. And then there's also, you know, there's other things that are happening too. So I do see that, you know, real estate Twitter is a wonderful source of knowledge. I learn all the time. You know, sometimes people will say things around, you know, like taxes. I think I joined somebody's thing on taxes. I'm always looking to learn more about that. So I, you know, I'm open to growth also. So I learn a lot from real estate Twitter. I like them very much. I've had some really wonderful operators in real estate as clients. And so I'm always like, you know, kind of trying to keep my ear to the wall on a variety of industries just so I keep up personally.
That's really, really cool. How do you, I know this is way off topic, but how do you staff a farm? Who's managing the farm?
Well, you know, a lot of it is, this is going to sound, well, this is great because you're a storage guy. A lot of it is automated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get things that we bought a farm that did not have the systems in place. So much like storage where you get the mom and pop stuff where it's not optimized. And so all of our billing goes out to people who are boarding on a regular basis. It's pretty automated. The way in which the facilities are managed is very, it's already kind of set up. We don't have, the farm is largely self-managed by the people who are like they board horses and other things here. So they are responsible, and how we have those, you know, contracts structured is makes it very clear, you know, kind of what their responsibilities are. We hire people to help with some areas of the business. So for example, like with fencing and things like that, mm-hmm. We're fortunate to have an Amish population that is exceedingly good at what they do, and who can come in and do some things like that. But a lot of it is just kind of self-managed and systems, using systems.
That's cool. So it's kind of like, is that like a triple net lease to the people? I don't know. It sounds kind of like that.
It's a solid structure, and I feel good about it. It's just one of those things that people don't think about farms. Farms are incredibly, they help incredibly with taxes as well. I mean, you have, you know, you have different programs for property taxes. You have different programs because you have a number of structures, and we're thinking about, you know, getting solar and doing all sorts of things. So we, you know, it can operate off grid for periods of time, but I'd love for it to be completely off grid. So that's my personal project that's coming up.
Very cool. I have one final question.
Sure.
And it's a selfish one. So John and I are in our third year of entrepreneurship. We're doing well, but we're still like a work in progress, I would call it, right? We're still scaling. We're still doing the thing. We're in a period of economic uncertainty for sure. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for us or people like us?
You know, the thing that I can say is that, you know, like in the past, when the economic environment was clear, you could make a lot of bigger strategic bets because you kind of had a clearer view of where the future was going, or at least it seemed like you did. I think now you kind of have to operate like you're in a bit of a fog. And when you're in a bit of a fog, you make moves and then you see what's in front of you. You make moves and you see what's in front of you. I think that you have to look at what are the moves that you can make right now and make them with some amount of assurance. And then you still like kind of look and see what those next moves are after that. I don't think that right now is a great time. I mean, it isn't for me to say, right? I'm not a real estate advisor, and real estate, I always expect that clients know more about their fields than I do. But what I do know is that when you're operating in uncertainty, you want to create two things. You want to create as much vision as possible. So you make moves and you create vision. You want to have as fast feedback loops as possible. So you don't want to have like long cycles to where you're going to have to wait to get feedback as in these decisions as much. But so I think that you operate and you navigate in uncertainty the best that you know how. You're starting out in a really uncertain time. And I would, you know, look at people who are much more skilled in real estate to look at what to do in those angles. Yeah. My job really is around looking at people. So I would ask, if I were working with you, some of the questions I'd start to ask is like, look, I can't give you advice on what to do in your business. But what I can tell you is tell me about, and don't do this, so we won't make this an open air like conversation session. But I would start to say things like, tell me about your concerns. What are the concerns you have? Is it about certain monetary risk? Is it about not getting certain amount of, you know, whatever? So tell me about your concerns, because that will tell me a lot about what your next move should or shouldn't be. Tell me a little bit about what you want from your business in the coming years. That will tell me a little bit about, you know, what you should and shouldn't be doing. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about, you know, where your spouse and others are on board or not on board with things, right? What are your, how, what's their risk tolerance look like? And tell me a little bit about, you know, if I were to say, okay, your goals in the next few years, what are your kind of long-term goals? You said you're starting to think more long-term. What does that look like to you? And are your current decisions really building toward that? Or are they on hold or on pause because the economic environment looks a little shaky or unpredictable? Because you can't put yourself on hold until everything looks right. But at the same time, you have to be mindful of the moves that you make if you're working toward a certain goal. And what's your time frame? Like, can you really reach that goal in a certain time frame if you're on pause for the next, you know, few years? So I would want to look at things like that. So I can't tell you, like, that's why the only things that I could really share are, you know, look at your systems, look at how the small steps you can take. But I'd be really interested in, so what's your concern when you say, hey, we're new here? Tell me a little bit about those, because I'm betting you have some. And mm-hmm. tell me about, like, what you really want. What's kind of the goal in the coming years with you and John? And what do you want to build toward? And are you kind of betting on storage entirely? Or are there other things that you're venturing into, considering, thinking about? So there's all sorts of things that I would kind of go into in that way. But I would really dig into you a bit more and less into kind of the specifics of business.
Yeah, that's a great answer. That makes a lot of sense. And then lastly, book recommendation. I'm expecting a good one.
Are you?
Yes. A lot of pressure.
I will tell you this. I'm not, and this is going to, maybe this is a bad answer. So I'll give you a couple of them. One is that I'm less of a book person and more of an interview person. And I think that the best insights come from listening to interviews with great people, because books oftentimes are written by ghostwriters. So yeah. you're getting a very filtered version of what, even though I love biographies and autobiographies, they're probably my favorite. And I love some of the ones that, you know, were written by the actual individual, but they are very rare. So I would start watching interviews with people that you really admire. And I would go that route more than anything else. So I would look at in-depth interviews. I've probably watched, or documentaries, right? Like where you see the person themselves. But right now I'm reading A Hacker's Mind by Bruce Schneider. That's one I put out recently. I think Hacker's Mind. But it talks really about how each of us, like when you look at Peter Thiel, for example, how he has, like, hacking isn't just about computers. It's about beating systems.
Yeah.
And that the best people beat systems. That's how you really start to scale. And it's not about nefarious intentions or anything else. So for a book recommendation, that's the one I'm currently at the end of, and I can throw your way. But I do think that the highest value is in interviews, because that's where you're going to hear it from the horse's mouth, exactly kind of how they're thinking. And you can see people, like, you can watch Jeff Bezos early on in his career talk about space, for example. And, you know, he's very, very early in the beginning of his career. And they said, oh, what do you dream of doing? And he says, about going into space. And the whole audience laughs, and the interviewer kind of pushes back and laughs at him. And then you see, like, today, more recently, you know, now they're like, oh, do you see roads in space? Do you see this in space? And he's like, it's very different, right? Like, but he was the same. He didn't pull away from his dreams, and he didn't pull away from talking about the things sometimes that he saw. And that kind of conviction, that kind of not caring about, like, kind of the jeers of other people, that kind of self-knowledge and knowing, you know, kind of what you want to do with yourself, I think is a real strength. I guess I could end with that.
Yeah, that's great. Doctor, where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Gurner, DrGurner. Feel free to message me anytime or engage. You can also find me through the newsletter, Ultra Successful, on Substack.
Thank you, Doc. We are super lucky to have you on today. I'm going to call it right there. This was a great, great interview. Thank you for your time and see everybody next week. Peace.
Thank you so much.